Before belief hardened into creed, before theology became something you could pass or fail, before priests learned how to soften revelation into something manageable, there was a voice. She didn't ask to be believed. She didn't wait to be interpreted. She arrived like the weather, sudden, disruptive, undeniable. She said she was the first and the last, and everything that refuses to sit politely between them. She said she was honored and despised in the same very breath. She said she was holy and defiled, mother and daughter, silence and speech. And those who heard her did not know whether to kneel, flee, or cover their ears, because this voice did not comfort, because she did not resolve the paradox. She did not explain herself. She spoke anyway. This is the thunder, perfect mind. The Thunder Perfect Mind is one of the most startling texts to survive from late antiquity. It doesn't behave like scripture. It doesn't offer doctrine, narrative, or moral instruction. Instead, it offers an encounter. The text was discovered back in 1945 near Nag Hammadi, Egypt, buried in a sealed jar along with over 50 other works. These writings were hidden sometime in the 4th century. Likely when possessing unapproved texts had become dangerous, their burial was not casual, it was protective. The Thunder survives in Coptic, the final written form of ancient Egyptian language, using Greek letters with traces of older scripts woven in. This linguistic hybridity, it matters. It places the text at a cultural crossroads. Egyptian religious memory, Greek philosophy, Jewish wisdom traditions, and emerging Christian language all converge here. And yet, this text belongs fully to none of them. What we actually encounter is a first-person divine monologue spoken in a feminine voice that refuses containment. There is no name given, no genealogy, and no apology, only speech. The thunder doesn't unfold logically, it strikes. It opens without introduction. It says, "I was sent from power, and I have come to those who reflect upon me." From the first line, authority is asserted without mediation. The speaker doesn't quote scripture or even invoke tradition. She doesn't explain where her authority comes from. She simply speaks from it. What follows is a cascading sequence of paradoxes, and it reads as follows. "I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin." These statements, they're not poetic flourishes. They are destabilizing devices. Each line collapses a boundary that the listener relies on to organize reality. The structure mirrors thunder itself. There isn't a gradual build. There is impact, direct, reverberation, and even an aftershock. Meaning doesn't arrive through explanation, but through a form of resonance. This is not a text meant to be read silently. It is meant to be spoken aloud. It's meant to be heard in the body and allowed to disrupt the listener's internal order. To understand this text, we have to imagine how it would have been received by those who first heard it. In the 2nd and 3rd centuries, divine speech was understood as performative. When a god spoke, something happened. Oracles did not inform, they transformed. Mystery traditions, they used shock, contradiction, and disorientation to initiate the seeker into a deeper mode of knowing. Now I want you to imagine a small gathering, perhaps a household, perhaps a desert community, where someone stands and speaks these words aloud in the first person. "I am knowledge and ignorance. I am shame and boldness." The listeners would not have been passively absorbing this content. They would have been participating in an event. Some would have felt recognition. Some would have felt fear. Some would have felt anger. This voice does not reassure the listener of their goodness or their correctness. It strips away moral footing. It demands a different kind of listening, one that can hold contradiction without collapsing directly into judgment. For an audience that's shaped by Greek rhetoric, Egyptian religious multiplicity, and Jewish wisdom literature, this would have been both familiar and profoundly dangerous. That this text even survives in Coptic is not incidental. Egyptian religious consciousness had long understood divinity as complex, paradoxical, and multi-voiced. Goddesses like Isis, Neith, and Maat, they each held creative and destructive power simultaneously. Sacred speech, it was not obligated to resolve itself. When this feminine voice declares her totality, she echoes an older memory, one that predates Christian moral binaries. Yet the text also uses emerging Christian language, power, reflection, hearing, revelation. This suggests a community negotiating inheritance and rupture at the exact same time. The thunder stands at the fault line where older goddess cosmologies and newer theological structures were colliding. Scholars have struggled to categorize the thunder perfect mind. One of the scholars, George McGray, he describes it as a text that resists every genre that's even assigned to it. Not quite a hymn, not a sermon, not apocalypse. Elaine Pagels herself has noted how radically this text disrupts patriarchal theology by presenting unquestioned divine authority in a feminine voice. Scholar April DeConnick has suggested that the speaker function as a form of divine wisdom, perhaps Sophia, but not the fallen or repentant Sophia that's found in other Gnostic myths. This Sophia, she doesn't apologize. She doesn't descend and need rescue. She's the one who speaks from wholeness. So what unites these scholars' responses is an admission of difficulty. This text refuses to sit still. The Thunder Perfect Mind was written to preserve a way of knowing that was being erased. By the 3rd and 4th centuries, Christian authority was consolidating. Doctrine was being formalized. Acceptable speech about God was greatly narrowing. Divine authority was becoming increasingly male, hierarchical, and morally policed. This text resists that narrowing by refusing moral sorting altogether. When the speaker says, "I am the one who is despised, and they look upon me," she refuses the logic of purity that undergirds institutional control. The thunder may have functioned as a counter-liturgy, a spoken ritual that reminded its hearers that divine authority doesn't belong solely to bishops, councils, or even approved texts. It preserves a voice that would not survive exposure. We do not know the author's identity, and the anonymity is likely intentional. What we can say is that the author was deeply educated. The text demonstrates fluency in philosophical paradox, rhetorical cadence, and layered religious symbolism. This was not the work of an isolated mystic. It likely emerged from a community that valued experiential revelation over institutional belonging. The absence of polemic is very telling. The text doesn't attack orthodoxy. It simply speaks from a place that renders orthodoxy irrelevant. That suggests a quiet strategy. Awaken individuals rather than confront power directly. The phrase perfect mind is itself a teaching, disguised as a title. In the ancient world, perfection meant completeness, not flawlessness. A perfect mind is one that is not divided against itself. When the speaker declares, "I am knowledge and ignorance," she's not expressing confusion. She's expressing totality. This challenges a worldview obsessed with certainty, coherence, and moral performance. The thunder offers a vision of intelligence that doesn't resolve tension, it contains it. A divine feminine voice speaking without mediation is profoundly destabilizing. She's not symbolic, she's not allegory, she's not softened into metaphor. She addresses humans and angels alike. She says, "Give heed then, you hearers, and you also, the angels." This is authority that doesn't ask for permission. It's not difficult to see why such a text would be buried. The voice, it doesn't teach obedience. She's the one who awakens sovereignty. The Thunder Perfect Mind doesn't ask you to agree. It asks you to stay present while your categories begin to dissolve. It mirrors every identity you cling to and then refuses to let you rest in any of them. This can be considered threshold literature. You are meant to feel very unsettled, and in that unsettlement, something else begins to speak. Why does this text matter today? Well, One could argue that we live in a time that's obsessed with coherence, branding, and moral clarity. The thunder offers a different type of medicine. It tells the truth of contradiction. It gives language to those who have been shamed for complexity, especially women and mystics whose lived experience cannot be neatly categorized. For modern listeners, this text can feel like permission to stop explaining yourself. It reminds us that wholeness isn't tidy. Now, if this voice still lives, and I believe she doesn't live only in ancient manuscripts. She lives in the places where your life refuses simplification. She speaks when you're both radiant and when you're uncertain. She speaks when your story will not resolve into something respectable. This is where the thunder still moves. I will now read an excerpt from The Thunder, Perfect Mind. In case anybody's interested, you can find this online in the Nag Hammadi Library, and this excerpt is translated by the scholar George McRae. I was sent forth from the power, and I have come to those who reflect upon me, and I have been found among those who seek after me. Look upon me, you who reflect upon me, and you hearers, hear me. You who are waiting for me, take me to yourselves, and do not banish me from your sight, and do not make your voice hate me, nor your hearing. Do not be ignorant of me anywhere or any time. Be on your guard. Do not be ignorant of me. For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I am the members of my mother. I am the barren one, and many are her sons. I am she whose wedding is great, and I have not taken a husband. I am the midwife, and she who does not bear. I am the solace of my labor pains. I am the bride and the bridegroom, and it is my husband who begot me. I am the mother of my father, and the sister of my husband, and he is my offspring. I am the slave of him who prepared me. I am the ruler of my offspring, but he is the one who begot me before the time on a birthday, and he is my offspring in due time, and my power is from him. I am the staff of his power in his youth, and he is the rod of my old age, and whatever he wills happens to me. I am the silence that is incomprehensible and the idea whose remembrance is frequent. I am the voice whose sound is manifold and the word whose appearance is multiple. I am the utterance of my name. Why, you who hate me, do you love me and hate those who love me? You who deny me, confess me, and you who confess me, deny me. You who tell the truth about me, lie about me, and you who have lied about me, tell the truth about me. You who know me, be ignorant of me, and those who have not known me, let them know me, for I am knowledge and ignorance. I am shame and boldness. I am shameless. I am ashamed. I am strength and I am fear. I am war and peace. Give heed to me. I am the one who is disgraced and the great one. Give heed to my poverty and my wealth. Do not be arrogant to me when I am cast out upon the earth, and you will find me in those that are to come. And do not look upon me on that dung heap, nor go and leave me cast out, and you will find me in the kingdoms. And do not look upon me when I am cast out among those who are disgraced and in the least places, nor laugh at me, and do not cast me out amongst those who are slain in violence. But I am compassionate and I am cruel. Be on your guard. Do not hate my obedience, and do not love my self-control. In my weakness, do not forsake me, and do not be afraid of my power. For why do you despise my fear and curse my pride? But I am she who exists in all fears and strength and trembling. I am she who is weak, and I am well in a pleasant place. I am senseless, and I am wise. Why have you hated me in your counsels? For I shall be silent amongst those who are silent, and I shall appear and speak. I am the judgment and the acquittal. I am sinless, and the root of sin derives from me. I am lust in appearance, and interior self-control exists within me. I am the hearing which is attainable to everyone, and the speech which cannot be grasped. I am mute who does not speak, and great is my multitude of words. Hear me in gentleness, and learn of me in roughness. I am she who cries out. and I am cast forth upon the face of the earth. I prepare the bread and my mind within. I am the knowledge of my name. I am the one who cries out, and I listen. The Thunder Perfect Mind, it doesn't ask to be resolved or domesticated. It speaks from the place where contradiction is no longer a problem. Rather, it's a revelation. The voice that says, I am the first and the last, refuses the categories that once confined the sacred to obedience, coherence, or silence. What this text leaves us with is not an answer, but a reorientation, a remembering that the divine speaks from within paradox, from within the body, from within the places that were never meant to be split apart. If we let this voice work on us, it doesn't soothe us. It reorders us. It asks us to listen differently, to hold complexity without fear, and to recognize that what was once called dangerous, excessive, or unspeakable may in fact be the very ground of revelation itself.